And our third talk today for this session is by Nahani Freeman and Mark Parker, and they will both be speaking, I understand. So, and the topic is serotonin transporter, gene polymorphism, response inhibition, auditory attention, and emotional variations. So there's a lot there in the title. Something for everybody. So Nahani, you're saying.
So I'm Nahani Freeman. I'm a clinical psychologist. A lot of my training during grad school was in mental testing, and I did a postdoc in neuropsychological assessment and medical psychology. So I work with Dr. Parker at CCU, and we had some discussions last year about how we might forge a collaboration between my interest in mental testing and his work in genetics. And so by way of introduction, I just wanted to mention, speak louder, that it has long been known in the field of psychiatry that there's a relationship between psychiatric symptoms and levels of serotonin. And so we have psychopharmacological agents that target serotonin reuptake, for instance, and they're used to treat a range of anxiety disorders and depression and other conditions. We were interested in looking at how the serotonin transporter gene and specific polymorphisms in the alleles may relate to other kinds of psychological symptoms, including impulsivity. And so for the background research, we discovered that there were at least five different psychological traits that seemed to be attached to a short allele of the serotonin transporter gene, including increased aggression in response to chronic stress, a decreased evaluation of risk and perceiving risk to be less aversive, changes in activation patterns on PET scans in response to noxious stimuli, increased impulsivity, and decreased delayed gratification. And some of these studies that have been performed in the past used self-report data as well as some cognitive testing. And so we sought to do a pilot study. We hope to expand the sample size and develop the study more. We're going to present some preliminary aspects of the psych findings today. So I'll just mention a couple of the previous studies that were done. Nomura and colleagues found that the serotonin transporter gene may relate to the evaluation of risk in a sample of Japanese females. They found that the evaluation of potential risk was more related to the polymorphism than motor output. In the Conway study, they looked at 381 Australian youth, and they had for their dependent variables a range of rating scales by parents and teachers and a structured interview. They found that there was a variation in the promoter region of 5-HTT-LPR that such that short allele carriers showed increased aggression if they had also been exposed to chronic stress. The Kilpatrick study examined a small sample of 23 healthy males, and they exposed these males to a noxious visceral stimulus, and then they measured after exposure to this stimulus, they measured their response of cerebral blood flow on a PET scan. And they found that those who had the short allele showed increased activation in the thalamus, the insula, the basal ganglia, the prefrontal cortex, and the parietal cortex, and deactivation in the amygdala and the hippocampus. Polymorphisms have also been examined in a literature review by Bavilacqua and Goldman, and these authors found that the polymorphisms had a relationship to impulsivity in both rodent and human samples, and they defined the impulsivity as a tendency to act without foresight, identifying four different domains of impulsivity, including attentional impulsivity, failure to inhibit motor actions, seeking immediate gratification and small rewards over delay and longer rewards, and increased risky behavior. Okay, I better move on. For our methods, we gave a series of tests. Some of these are self-report tests and some are cognitive measures. The brief test of attention looks at auditory divided attention. You present the participants with a sequence of letters and numbers and have them identify the numbers, number of letters and numbers, so it requires working memory. The Stroop color word test is a very old test. It goes back, actually, the first studies were done by the father of psychology, Wilhelm Wundt, in the late 1800s in Leipzig. And with this test, there is the person first completes reading a series of words, and then they complete a task where they read the ink in which the words are printed but ignore the words. So it's an interference task where they have to inhibit a well-learned response and focus on another response. We also gave the trail-making A and B tests, which are part of the Halstead-Raton neuropsychological battery, and this is a sequencing task where the participant first does kind of a dot-to-dot with numbers, and then they do a sequencing back and forth between numbers and letters. The trails has been shown to be actually rather predictive in identifying the progress of dementia patients. Muriel Lezak has talked about how there's a strong correlation between performance on trails and the daily living skills of dementia patients. And then we gave the Barrett Impulsivity Scale, which includes several subscales, and the Costello Anxiety and Depression Scale. These are both self-report tools. Buccal swabs were taken for the purpose of isolating the genomic DNA. And all of these aspects of the battery were completed in a single setting. Our demographics, we have a small sample. We hope to enlarge the sample in the future. Our sample was very homogeneous, which is very typical of the undergrad research that we do at CCU. Predominantly female. There was a very high representation of psychology majors in the sample. And that's because we can offer credit for participating. And very little variation in terms of self-identification of denomination. You can see 99.6% identify themselves as non-denominational Christian. Very strong Caucasian representation and a restricted range for age. So these are all things that we would need to improve in the future. So we'll just present some of the preliminary findings from the correlation coefficients for the psych data. So in our study, some of the correlations were relatively small. Correlations above 0.24 are significant at the p less than 0.05 level for a one-telled test. There was lower cognitive complexity was related to inattention and lower levels of self-control. Cognitive complexity is one of the subscales on the Barrett impulsivity measure, and this is typically thought of as a trait where a person can entertain multiple categories of understanding of a topic and engage in complex problem solving and tends to prefer that kind of problem solving. We also found that lower cognitive complexity predicted more color interference on the Stroop. There were a lot of correlations between different cognitive tasks. Cognitive complexity, according to Akira and colleagues, requires selective attention, and it is also likely kind of a distinctive composite of several cognitive skills, including the inhibition of automatic responses, information updating and monitoring, and mental shifting. We found that motor impulsivity showed a strong relationship with lower self-control, which was also one of the subscales on the Barrett. Lower self-control related to more anxiety and depression, which was consistent with what you would expect based on the diagnostic and statistical manual's description. And we found that cognitive instability correlated with anxiety. Cognitive instability in this case is defined as racing, extraneous thoughts, and having the subjective perception of being unable to control one's thoughts. This was consistent with background research performed by other researchers on the relationship between anxiety, depression, and self-control. And I don't really have time to talk about those studies, but if you're interested, I could talk with you about it after. Okay, second set of data here. We found that anxiety and depression strongly related to one another. This was not an unexpected finding because there tends to be very high comorbidity between anxiety disorders and depressive disorders, as shown by Fava et al., who found that 50% of adult outpatients in their sample showed comorbid anxiety and depressive conditions. One of the things that was surprising in our data was the kind of lack of relationship between cognitive performance and auditory attention and mental shifting and the Stroop interference task and the emotional variables. I would have expected a stronger relationship there, and it could be an issue with power, with a small sample size, or some other variable related to the administration of the tools or our sample dynamics. For instance, other studies have demonstrated that even self-report measures of mental illness or symptoms associated with psychiatric disturbance do tend to correlate with cognitive performance. Watkins and Brown in 2002 found that following a rumination induction, which would be getting the participant to think repetitively about something, depressed patients showed poorer executive functioning than non-depressed subjects on random number generation tasks. And this difference was not observed between the groups following a distraction induction, which may imply that it's not something specifically about the depression that leads to cognitive inhibition, but rather it's mediated through a ruminative process that's interfering with the attentional process. In bipolar patients, depression was found to correlate with memory impairment and psychomotor slowing, while hypomania correlated with frontal executive deficits. Last data I want to mention today is I sorted the variables according to subject variables, high and low, on the impulsivity on the Barrett. And then also I did this with the brief test of attention, high and low performance. And what I found replicates prior research to show that there is a significant difference between performance on A and B. However, Lezak argues that these differences between A and B do not provide any evidence of laterality, and they don't seem to indicate differences between psychiatric populations and traumatic brain injury populations. But I did not see an interaction effect when we looked at that by high versus low impulsivity, and also did not see an interaction effect when we looked at high versus low levels of auditory attention and compared that with A versus B performance on the trails. So we have a number of things that we're going to work on for future studies, and one of the things we'll need to do is cross-validate the way that we collected data, because we modified some of the administration for a group administration format for some of the neuropsychological tools. We'll need to validate that and counterbalance the tools and so forth.
Thank you, Dr. Freeman. So we're going to switch gears completely from psychology to a little molecular genetics. So at the beginning, she mentioned the serotonin transporter, okay, and that's what I'm going to talk about. So the idea here is that we teach at a small undergraduate-only institution with very little time, budget, et cetera, for research. So we have to kind of carve this out on our own. So what I did was I recruited some undergraduate researchers, two of whom are here with us today, to actually administer the test to fellow students and then see if we could do the genotyping in our labs, inexpensively, using undergraduate student researchers to give them some tools and to give us some data to try and expand their understanding of the way biomedical research works, the way meetings like this works, the way you present your data, that sort of thing. So we looked at it from the cellular end of the phenomena rather than the psychological end of the phenomena. Okay, so Dr. Freeman mentioned the serotonin transporter, the 5-HTT-LPR, and I'm sure the vast majority of you have no idea what that means. So I'm going to try and unpack that a little bit. So this gene encodes a serotonin transporter protein, and this protein functions on the presynaptic cell synapses, so the one cell that's telling the other cell what to do. What it does is it regulates the reuptake of the neurotransmitter from the synapse. So it's effectively changing the level of the neurotransmitter, changing the level of the signaling at the synapse by its functionality. Okay, so you guys have probably heard of Prozac. I imagine you've seen the commercial probably today at some point. The drug that that's based on is what's called a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. It's a mouthful. You might have heard the term SSRI. The idea is these drugs directly interfere with the protein we're looking at, and they allow it to slow the reuptake of serotonin, effectively leaving more neurotransmitter at the synapse, which effectively increases the functionality, the concentration, however you want to think about it, right? Turns out that these polymorphisms that we find in this gene sort of work as endogenous Prozac because they affect the rate of expression, the level of expression, how well your synapses reuptake serotonin. Okay, so these polymorphisms are theoretically very functional. So let's talk about what we mean. Okay, the little 5-HTT-LPR here is an acronym that was invented to describe what the protein does, or what, I'm sorry, what these polymorphisms do in the protein. Most of you can think of mutation, that changes the protein, which changes its function. This is even more confusing. This is in the promoter region, okay? So the promoter region, down here is the part of the gene that actually makes a protein. Upstream here in the promoter, this is where signals bind and tell the cell, hey, make more of that. Polymorphisms in the promoter region then will change how much of the protein the cells actually make. These polymorphisms are here in the promoter region, and they effectively change the level of messenger RNA you make, which affects the levels of physical protein you make. Right? You guys with me? So, mutation is not in the protein itself. It should function the same between individuals, but it's in the control of the level of the protein that you're making. Okay? When we first started this investigation, what we saw was that there is a biallelic distribution in populations. So polymorphisms, different forms, two different forms, biallelic. Some people have a short allele, some people have a long allele. There's an extra insert in here. You get different levels of expression of the protein. All right, so we started our research based on this. What we did was when my students administered these psychological tests, at the same time, we gave everybody a little plastic tube, sterile, with a few mils of sterile saline in it, and told them, okay, uncap the thing, put it in your mouth, and swish it around for 60 seconds. Keep swishing. Swish harder. Come on, you're getting there. 60. They spit it back in the tube, capped it off, and we now have a sample of the cells lining their mouth, buccal cells. Okay? So from there, we went on to, and these pictures are not showing up very well, unfortunately. Believe me when I say, this is a ladder of DNA to tell us how big things are. And in each of these lanes, there's a big smear at the top, you can see this one pretty clearly, that represents the genomic DNA that we isolated from each of these 49 individuals. Okay? So with that genomic DNA then, we can go back and look and see which one are you. Right? And our strategy was to do this using PCR. So we can take a primer that sits down here, a primer that sits down here, and amplifies back, and we should be able to get two bands on a gel of different sizes depending on whether or not you have the short allele or the long allele. Seems fairly straightforward. You can't see this at all. Good thing I put arrows there. So this is some preliminary PCR data. What we end up with is this band corresponds to 500 base pairs. The long allele is here, here, and here. Use your imaginations. The short allele is here as well. So theoretically then, we've demonstrated that in our little lab with no money and no resources and using students who were learning this the first time, we can generate genotypes from a simple buccal sample administered at this, or collected at the same time we administered these tests. So, fantastic. We may be able to generate some real data here. But as I dug deeper into the literature, I realized it's more complex. So there are more recent studies that are showing that not only do you have a short allele and a long allele, but in some people's long allele, there's an A to G base substitution here. which actually changes expression levels. It interferes with a binding site for a transcription factor. And so you have S alleles expressing at a lower level, L alleles expressing at a longer level, but L alleles that have a mutation look like S alleles. So functionally, the L with the base substitution works like an S. Wait, what? Let's try a graph. So this is just an optimized comparison of actual levels of messenger RNA that different people express. Okay. The SS phenotype, you got a short allele from mom, you got a short allele from dad. Remember, you have two copies of each chromosome. You got one from dad, you got one from mom. Mom could have given you an S, dad could have given you an L. So you have different possibilities. The SS phenotype is set at a baseline of 1. The LL wild-type phenotype gives more than double expression typically. Okay? But the problem is, if you have the L with the G, it expresses like the S. It expresses very similar if it's the SL. If you're both L, but 1A, 1G, you're moderate. We need to be able to account for this. Right? And so what we're planning on doing now is looking at the ability of not just doing the PCR here, but then we're also going to have to analyze these L phenotypes further. Okay? And I've come up with a couple different ways to do it. One way could be as simple as for every L phenotype we have, it turns out that that mutation actually introduces a new restriction site here. So if we can generate a large enough quantity of DNA and PCR, get the L phenotype, and then we can just use a restriction enzyme. If it cuts, it's the L with the change. If it doesn't cut, it doesn't have the substitution. So preliminarily, we've shown that we can do this. A couple of things we're going to have to account for, obviously. But I think we can do PCR in lab. We can collect the genomic DNA as we administer the tests. So it's a one-shot thing. I think it took us about 15 minutes to administer the full tests and collect the buccal swabs. So this is something that we can go into our classrooms and do. The problem with that, as Dr. Freeman mentioned, is we're a small undergraduate Christian institution. That means a high population of females to males. We need to account for that. And very small age demographic. Also very small racial demographic, right? So we're going to have to look into that. At some point, we're going to run into problems with the quality of the DNA we're isolating in this way. So we're going to have to address that, possibly by the use of commercial kits. So we're trying to do this on the cheap. But we've now demonstrated we can do it, so we may be able to get a little bit of funding, use commercial kits to do the DNA isolation, give us cleaner DNA, possibly give us larger quantities of DNA to make the PCR amplification a little bit easier. Then, like I said, we have to address this A to G phenotype we've discovered, so what we're going to need to do is some sort of digestion, or possibly doing something like real-time PCR, next-generation sequencing, to address this as well. But what I think we've been able to show is that using limited resources, training undergraduate students to do much of the work, that we're going to be able to have a synthesis between the psychological factors involved and the genotyping involved, and see if we can get some correlations between genetic polymorphisms and psychological traits and behaviors. We can do it in our labs, using our own students, and get the benefit of training them in these processes and administering these tests, and I think build a nice collaboration between our science department and our psychology department. Okay. I would like to recognize, since they're here, two of our undergraduate researchers are here, Reagan Rudkin and James Graver, did the administration of the tests, the collecting of the buccal swabs, the genomic DNA purifications, and those preliminary PCR results. So thank you very much. Another one of our undergraduates is here as well. You'll be presenting a poster this afternoon, Zoe. So she's here as well. So I realize I'm standing between you and lunch, so I'll cut it off there, and we'll take any questions. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
It appears to have commercial potential.
How so?
People in this room, let's take a survey. Who would like to know if they have this mutation that makes them more depressed?
Who would like to know?
Everybody's so secure.
Oh, it's graphic. Does it up here? I want to know.
Yeah. But it seems to extend, I just was wondering if you're going to patent it or do anything.
Well, lots of people have done this, right? They've looked at the same polymorphism for other things as well. We're kind of taking it in a new direction, but other people have done this. It's in the literature. The PCR primers that I'm using are ones that have already been published, that sort of thing. So I don't know about commercializing it, but potentially might pay for itself. That would be a fantastic endeavor. Yes, sir.
I guess I sit here and say with 47 patients or so, you could see with one neurotransmitter these big differences, or because, whether there are 130 neurotransmitters, and one like dopamine has four different receptors that it takes up, and all these effects. So I was a little surprised you could do that. Second issue is, have you identified genetic predisposition to SAN?
Personally, no.
obviously for impulsive, actually it could be used very helpful as a psychologist. Say, look, we know from your tests, we know from your genes that you're impulsive. You ought to really take more time to make out some of your decisions. Mm-hmm. Let's start to put some cognitive psychology, some cognitive counseling into this type of issue. So, I guess, and the other issue is, did you see a difference in terms, obviously small numbers, but between the ones who had the genetic predisposition and those who showed the opposite on the psychological test?
We haven't been able to correlate all the genotypes. We haven't generated all the genotypes yet. We haven't matched them with the analysis of the genetic testing yet. So that's the next student coming in August. And this fall's goal is to create all the genotypes and then match them to the genetic tests. So what we've done is we've anonymized all the data. So we have all the data from the psychological testing. We're still generating advanced genotypes. And as far as some of the other stuff, I'm not aware, it's not my field, but is anybody doing genotyping and that sort of thing as an aid to psychological counseling, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I'm not really aware of that being a major force in right now. Typically, the diagnoses that we make are behavioral diagnoses. We have access to medical records, so in the case of like a diagnosed medical condition, that would interact with the treatment. But that's an interesting idea for research.
There is a big field in genotyping connected to, for example, MAO, so several other genes. Looking at GWAS studies, very large populations, and correlating with aggression, hostility, many behavioral phenotypes. I'm not a great fan of those studies, so I won't comment further. There's a long way to go before this is going to show, you're genetically susceptible, right? I think you'd agree with that.
Yeah, can be a slippery slope, though. Just because you're genetically predisposed may not mean you give into that
I have a question that's more practical, perhaps, and that is, do you have an IRB?
Yes.
Did you have a board and that you approve this study? Because I don't think it would get approved at my institution, because you're finding out information that could have some implications or even damage to the individual. And if it's done in a classroom situation, is there a feeling that the students are coerced in any way?
A couple things with that. So the way we dealt with that is every student who completes it is offered extra credit, but every student who opts not to is also offered other opportunities to get the same credit. So we've removed the coercion. The other thing is it's completely blinded.
So the students don't know their information. We don't know the students' information. Everything is completely anonymized. So we've tried to remove all risk. The only low risk that we identified when we were running through the IRB was the idea that sometimes the self-evaluation and the self-reporting can lead to depression and that sort of thing. So we included, I believe, in our release form, the waiver that they signed, information about the student counseling services and that sort of thing. So we've tried to minimize all risk.
Okay, so it's completely anonymous. They're not going to know they have the mutation.
You guys did your own samples, right? But yours just has a number. You don't even know what your own is. So we've tried to complete that.
Okay. All
right. Unless you cheat.
Yes. You mentioned medical records. Are you controlling for medication that these people are taking?
I don't think we had anything about that in the survey.
Actually, that's a really good idea to expand to the.
If somebody was on something like from the. Yes?
A technical question. Have you seen heterozygotes in your PCR reactions?
Yes.
You only showed it.
Yes. Okay. We're still working out some of the kinks. The major thing we're running into, I'm sure with your background you're well aware, different people switch harder, give you more cells, and so the same amount of genomic DNA loaded into the PCR gives you radically different results. So we need to normalize for that. We first pass, we tried to do it as quickly, low cost, so we didn't quantitate every genomic sample, and so we're getting a ton of variability. So one band, or one lane, no PCR results, the next lane, fantastic PCR results, the next lane, spurious bands all over the place, and so that's the sort of variability we're running into. I have seen, I believe, at least one heterozygote on a PCR.
In connection with that, what is the frequency of the short allele?
40, I think it's about 46, something like that. Yeah. It's almost even, not quite.
Kathy, you have a question?
Yeah, I'm a therapist, so I'm looking at it from like the other point, you know, perspective, like cognitive behavioral psychoanalytics therapy does affect the brain, right?
Yes.
And so, I think research has shown that therapy is just as effective as antidepressants in curing or treating depression. Mm-hmm. So would somehow if a good amount of psychotherapy actually make a difference in the way the brain processes serotonin, regardless of the, will that have an effect, you know, what how we learn and what we do affects our brain chemistry, just as our brain chemistry affects our mood. So I wonder if it goes the other direction.
I would hypothesize yes, although you're getting out of my field very quickly there. One of the things that's always fascinating for me is based on the way that these drugs work, you would think, okay, here's this reuptake inhibitor, don't you feel better now? And you can testify it takes months to titrate these, right? That makes no sense physiologically, right? Psychologically, maybe it does, but physiologically, you're immediately affecting the levels of that neurotransmitter, but it doesn't take an immediate effect.
Placebos work just as effectively.
Yeah. So, is the effect of these drugs simply a long-term placebo effect? That's one theory that I've heard. So I don't have a good answer for that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
So thanks to all the speakers. Thanks to the